It was an extraordinary new experience. It's like sort of being in a new planet.
It's a very happy unit, really, all together, when you think of all the different nationalities, all working for a common end, and the great excitement, the whole place buzzed.
It was a tremendous experience, humanly, professionally, politically.
The atmosphere was hectic, but rather cheerful in the sense that everybody felt that they were doing something, and that was better than doing nothing.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very hard work at times, and I can remember some bitter winters, but some lovely summers, and going up to work in the evenings, the marvellous sunsets behind the Morven Hills. Yes, I felt it was something worth doing that I could do, and a lovely job.
Present Listening to War, the story of the BBC's monitoring service in the Second World War. The narrator is Alvar Liddell.
Aus dem Führerhauptquartier 3. Februar 1943. Das Oberkommando der Wehrmacht gibt bekannt. Der Kampf um Stalingrad ist zu Ende.
On Wednesday, the 3rd of February 1943, a special communique from Hitler's High Command was broadcast by the German Home Service. It caused widespread dismay among the civilian population of the Third Reich, but one listener for whom it was not intended, carefully transcribing the communique in a country house deep in rural Worcestershire, heard it with joy. The translation, which was soon on its way to London, was, however, strictly factual.
From the Führer's headquarters, the High Command of the Armed Forces announces, "The struggle for Stalingrad has ended. Loyal to their oath to the last breath, the Sixth Army, under the exemplary leadership of Field Marshal Paulus, had to succumb to the numerical..."
Combined with the British victory at El Alamein a few months before and the American landing in North Africa, the Russian triumph at Stalingrad seemed to make Germany's final defeat certain. But long before reporting that communique, the BBC monitoring service had established itself as an indispensable part of the nation's information gathering machine. Every day, 500 employees were listening to and editing more than 1 million words in 30 languages. A brief but comprehensive roundup of the previous day's material was prepared every day, and a much fuller daily digest, often the length of a full-scale novel, was circulated to 600 recipients in government departments, allied embassies, newspapers, and, most important of all, the BBC's own news departments. Monitors, editors, reference librarians, and typists worked in shifts round the clock. The origins of this major enterprise had been more humble. They went back 5 years to 1938, when, to counter the anti-British propaganda already being poured out by Germany and Italy, the BBC had begun to broadcast in foreign languages. The contracts of the first recruits to that language service contained a then novel clause.
Your duties will include listening to, reporting on, and transcribing foreign language broadcasts.
No special receivers or premises were provided at that time. The foreign transmissions were picked up by the BBC's receiving station at Tatsfield and passed by landline to London. Among the first people to perform this still totally new listening task was David Bowman.
It was an extremely limited, very, very limited operation. We monitored in an office on the third floor in Broadcasting House, and they translated the material, which I had the task of sort of putting into correct English and circulating to various customers we had.
So valuable did the new service prove, both to the BBC and to the government, that, as the international situation worsened, discussions took place on expanding the existing arrangements as soon as war began. By early 1939, this seemed inevitable.
From assistant controller overseas to deputy director general, secret. Comments on monitoring proposals. 5th of June, 1939. We have suggested a 24 hours monitoring service because it seems to us that it will be important for government departments concerned and the BBC to have immediate knowledge of what is being broadcast in wartime from non-enemy and enemy countries. We ourselves are planning what is virtually a 24-hour program for both home and overseas. Should we not presume that other countries will take similar action? There is no doubt that monitoring on the scale envisaged in our proposals is bound to be an expensive business.
At this time, the extra cost of the whole monitoring operation was only £2.10 a week, the wages of a single stenographer. Everyone else fitted in the work on top of their normal duties. While discussions about the future monitoring service had been going on in London, other BBC officials had been scouring the country in search of premises to which most of their London apartments could be evacuated as soon as war was declared. Dispersal was planned to many different locations, but one was needed which could also serve, if necessary, as the emergency headquarters of the BBC itself. Eventually, the choice fell on a property which, in its estate agent's particulars, sounded suitably spacious and imposing.
Wood Norton, Worcestershire. Evesham, 2 miles. A magnificently appointed mansion, reconstructed by the Duke d'Orléans about 40 years ago at a cost of £100,000. 40 acres, 9 reception rooms, 30 bedrooms, 7 bathrooms, swimming pool. There are 2 drives, the principal one entered through a pair of magnificent wrought iron gates from the Palace of Versailles.
The Duke d'Orléans had in fact been pretender to the French throne, as no visitor to Wood Norton was able to forget. For the fleur-de-lis motive was everywhere, on doorknobs, light switches, even in the bathrooms. The BBC spent £810 on a wooden hut, 6 receivers and some aerials, hoping to recover the cost from the government. The embryo Ministry of Information proved uncooperative. £4,000 for capital equipment and £24,000 for the initial running expenses were only grudgingly approved. Meanwhile, as the international situation grew visibly worse, the BBC found itself under pressure to provide more information immediately about what the German leaders were saying to their own people. Malcolm Frost, a future head of the monitoring service, was then director of overseas intelligence at the BBC.
Ogilvy, who was then director general, sent for me and said, look, Heather, why tore our Führer, the Prime Minister, was demanding to know what Hitler was saying immediately. Can you organise something straight away? I looked at the machine which had been planned and realised that it simply couldn't be made to work immediately and set up a purely temporary monitoring service at Beaconsfield and in the house of one of my staff. And we took as many receivers as we could down there and threw arrows out of windows. I took some of my foreign staff, particularly the Germans, down there to do the actual monitoring. And we rigged up a dispatch rider service with the aid of the War Office to take the stuff to Whitehall as fast as we could go. And this continued right up to the outbreak.
In those closing weeks of peace, as Wood Norton was made ready for his wartime role, the BBC began to select the monitors who would man it when the call to action came. Although this was a totally new type of job, finding suitable recruits proved surprisingly easy, as Richard Marriott, who soon afterwards became head of the monitoring service, discovered.
Any of the languages that we wanted to listen to, I think we've found it reasonably simple to find people who knew those languages and were ready to be employed by somewhere like the BBC as a wartime job. There were a lot of German refugees, especially a lot of young men who hadn't got jobs, and who later came to have distinguished careers both inside the BBC and outside it.
One rich source of candidates was found among men and women with linguistic qualifications who had previously applied unsuccessfully for a post with the BBC. A common characteristic of many of those who survived the selection procedure, which involved a paper in current affairs as well as more practical tests, was a highly cosmopolitan background with fluency in several foreign languages.
I was born in Russia, but actually I came to England as a refugee from Nazi Germany.
Anatole Goldberg.
And in the summer of 1939, to my surprise, I received a letter from the BBC asking me whether I should like to become a monitor. Then, fortunately, the letter went on to explain what a monitor was. It added, rather disconcertingly at the end, that the language for which I would be wanted would be Spanish. I had indicated Spanish on a BBC form, but I knew other languages better, let's put it that way, especially as I had taken my degree in Far Eastern languages.
To this recruited beast, with an uncertain income as a freelance journalist liable to dry up altogether if war broke out, the terms offered by the BBC seemed generous.
£300 a year, plus billeting accommodation, included breakfast and another meal. I found it absolutely magnificent. On the 25th of August, I got a telephone call telling me that I should be in Broadcasting House on the 26th. And when I arrived, I found a few other people like myself and were taken to Evesham by bus. It was a lovely day, but when we arrived in Evesham, it rained. Moreover, the city was celebrating what was known as Carnival. Now, to a continental, a Carnival celebration at the end of August on the eve of a world war had something apocalyptic about it. From the purely practical point of view, it created some difficulties. No one was at home. Everyone was celebrating. Those who were supposed to billet us were nowhere to be found. We waited at the station, and, of course, it was a wonderful feeling. We left everything to our superiors, to those who were responsible.
There was little time to savor the novelty of the situation, for the monitors were plunged almost at once into the demanding daily routine, which was to continue for most of them for the next 6 years. David Berman.
We set to work straight away. In fact, the moment we arrived, we started recording our bulletins, listening to them. I mean, as soon as war broke out, I mean, Germany became our priority, and we covered it round the clock, Berlin and the regional stations as well.
Among the German monitors was Werner Rubinstein, who had lived for 10 years in Berlin earlier in his life. He was summoned to Evesham directly after taking his finals at Cambridge and found a very different way of life.
The work was done in wooden huts. It was a very beautiful setting among the trees. You went to the rota board, on which you saw a list of commitments for the day. You also had a position schedule, because room was rather scarce and you had to take every bulletin in a special allocated place. And at that position you would find a receiver. Some are very simple domestic receivers and some are very sophisticated communication receivers. You also had recording equipment, and you then proceeded to make notes of everything you heard. Before that, of course, you had to intercept the program. Most of the tuning had to be done by the monitors themselves, who had never tackled anything technical in their lives before.
Finding the station one wanted, recording and taking notes was only part of the monitor's work.
A monitor was not allowed to select the material which he thought was important and transcribe it on the basis of his own judgment. He had to go to the editor in Information Bureau, report to him what he had heard, and he was then given instructions how to treat the material. That is to say, which parts of the material had to be transcribed in full and which had to be discarded or summarized or reported on.
This preliminary sifting, when the monitor reported what he or she had heard, was humorously known as confessing, a word not perhaps inappropriate to what was interior cloistered community of dedicated listeners where most of the words heard came from the world outside. But pleasant though these rural surroundings were, there were hazards, some due to the method of recording in those early days on wax cylinders, which could melt if left on a sunny windowsill, and which were also brittle.
Occasionally furious monitors used to hurl them at cubicle walls and break them, and monitors who thought that they couldn't hear them anyway had a little way of dropping them occasionally so you couldn't possibly hear them.
Lorna Swire, one of the team of monitors listening to foreign broadcasts in English. The autumn of 1939 was one of the sunniest and warmest of the century, just as the winter which followed it was to be the hardest in living memory. Evesham, surrounded by some of the most fertile countryside in England, was an exceptionally agreeable place to be in the opening months of the war, or would have been if so much of the monitor's work had not been deeply depressing. One of the earliest duties of the German monitors, who were mainly refugees from the Nazis, was to record and translate the speech in which Hitler celebrated his conquest of Poland.
The German nation is today celebrating a victory unique in history. A country which had a population of 36 million and an army of roughly 50 divisions opposed us. A week after the struggle had begun, the die had already been cast. Wherever Polish troops encountered German detachments, they were repelled.
Any broadcast by Hitler was a major event. Another broadcaster from Germany made daily appearances on the air.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender Hamburg, station Bremen, and station DXB on the 31-meter band. You are about to hear our news in English. The New York Times reports the British cruiser Exeter has
Hall was an stand. Institution. It took two of us to do him every night, 22:30.
More interesting for Lorna Squire and her colleagues were the so-called black stations operated by Germany but claiming to be manned by dissident Britons. On the 5th of March 1940, while winter and the phony war still lay upon Europe like a blight.
This is the new British broadcasting station, operating on 5,925 kilocycles and on a wavelength of 50.63 meters. Have you ever given any thought to the fate of your children? I mean, those who are old enough to have some idea of what is happening, but not old enough for military service. Do you realize that the government's evacuation plans, or should one say their complete collapse, may have a profound effect upon your boys and girls in years to come? Do you remember how in the months before last...
Other black stations were even less convincing. Workers' Challenge was one, full of crude language, and Radio Caledonia. Speculating about the identity or appearance of freedom broadcasters provided the monitors with a little light relief. Ray Barker, who had joined the BBC from the Ministry of Pensions, was another English language monitor.
We used to listen to these bulletins and we used to make mental pictures among ourselves of what they were like. There was one station, I think it called itself Christian Peace, and we imagined an unfrocked priest with soup stains all down his lapels, you know, and long hair.
And then suddenly there was very little to laugh at. On the morning of the 9th of April 1940...
The Supreme Command of the German Defence Forces announces the operations to occupy Denmark and the Norwegian coast have proceeded according to plan today.
The professional listeners of Evesham now heard, in a new language, the unmistakable voice of treason.
Proklamasjon til det norske folk. Efter at England hadde brutt Norges neutralitet...
Proclamation to the Norwegian people. After England had violated Norway's neutrality by laying minefields in Norwegian territorial waters, without encountering any resistance, apart from the usual fatuous protests from the Ny-Gårdsval government, The German government offered the Norwegian government its peaceful assistance.
For the next few weeks, the monitors heard on shift after shift only a tale of mounting disaster.
Depuis 15 jours, j'ai pris deux fois la parole. Chaque fois, c'est une mauvaise nouvelle que je vous ai annoncée. Le 21 mai, devant le...
Radio Paris, the 6th of June, 1940, Monsieur Reynaud's speech. In the last fortnight, I have delivered two speeches. On the 21st of May, I said to you, the King of the Belgians has betrayed us. The road to Dunkirk is open. Today, at an hour which still remains grave...
La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori. Agli ambasciatori di Gran Bretagna e di Francia.
Rome, the 10th of June, 1940. The declaration of war has already been handed to the ambassadors of Great Britain and France. We are in the field.
Français, à l'appel de Monsieur le Président de la République, j'assume à partir d'aujourd'hui la direction du gouvernement de la France.
Rennes, France, the 17th of June, 1940. Frenchmen, at the request of President Lebrun, as from today, I assume the direction of the French government. Certain of the affection of our admirable army, it is with a heavy heart that I must tell you, you must stop fighting. I have appealed to our adversary, asking him whether he is ready to discuss with me, honorably as between soldiers, the means to end hostilities.
Into the listening ears of the monitors flowed all the evidence of the enslavement of a continent. Between one shift and the next, the broadcasting map of Europe could change.
In the case of Denmark and Belgium and the Netherlands, I mean, all those stations closed down and sort of reappeared under German management the following morning. Well, our monitors were very experienced and they could tell. The announcers were different and they had a sort of jubilant tone when they were speaking of German victories. I mean, it was totally different.
Few had more to fear from a German victory than the refugees from Europe who thronged the listening room at Evesham. But there was little sign of depression.
We all took a very professional approach to the work, did it coldly and analytically, translated it as best we could.
As Hitler's empire expanded, so too did the monitoring service, as specialists were needed who spoke the language of each newly conquered country. Rigitze Edvardsen, whose homeland was Denmark, also knew Norwegian. She soon detected a difference in the way the two countries were being treated.
Denmark, you see, could produce food, a lot of food. The Germans were treating Denmark a little bit like the iron hand in the velvet glove. They went really rough with Denmark. Oslo was quite different. Oslo was a German station in a Norwegian language.
In addition to listening to German-inspired broadcasts in Europe, the monitors also kept a vigilant ear open for Nazi attempts to stir up trouble in the rest of the world. Elisa Ternström, although she monitored also Scandinavian, Dutch and other broadcasts from Germany, now proved to have an even more useful qualification. Thanks to being brought up in South Africa, she had mastered Afrikaans.
This was very important because at the time the Germans were trying to get South Africa to break away from the Allies, especially as there was quite a strong movement there called the Ossewa Brandwacht, which was trying to get South Africa to get out of the war, and the Germans were doing everything they could to encourage this.
The long, legendary year during which Great Britain lacked an active ally anywhere in the world, while everywhere Germany was triumphant or conspiring against her, ended dramatically.
Говорит Москва. С С рассветом 22 июня 1941 года регулярные войска.
This is Moscow, the 22nd of June 1941. At dawn, the German armies fell upon our country from the Baltic to the Black Sea without a declaration of war.
There was a sudden demand for Russian monitors. Vova Rubinstein, selected as a German speaker, now had reason to feel grateful for the years he had spent in Russia.
I happened to monitor the first wartime Stalin speech after the attack. Well, I must say that I was really a little bit overawed by this unexpected event. I knew that everybody would want to know every word that Stalin said, so I proceeded to listen. Now, the dreadful thing was that obviously he was broadcasting from some sort of studio which had been arranged or moved, possibly underground. The acoustics were absolutely terrible. I mean, add to that his Georgian accent, and most of the words were really quite incomprehensible. The only thing that was completely clear was the bubbling noise of water which he was drinking from time to time. Obviously, what everybody wanted to know was whether the Russians were going to give in, whether they were going to conclude peace, whether they were going to fight on. And I simply could not extract information from that speech because practically all the words were terribly blurred. Well, towards the end, I could at least say that the speech, the second part of the speech, certainly contained an appeal to fight on. And that, of course, was very encouraging.
The invasion of Russia was one of those rare occasions when, as Ray Barker observed, the staff of the monitoring service abandoned their customary attitude of professional detachment.
I don't understand a word of German or a word of Russia, but all the monitors who did were so excited they kept on standing up and yelling out what was happening, you know, how far the Germans had gotten.
The Russian retreat brought its own problems for the anxious listeners at Evesham.
As you can imagine, the Germans advanced rapidly. They covered enormous distances, and as they advanced, the Soviet home service network began to crumble, and as time went on, more and more transmitters were withdrawn. Some new transmitters appeared, which were very poor quality and operated in a very erratic manner. One didn't quite know on what frequencies they were going to operate.
Fortunately, this problem, not merely in Russia, but in every area to which Evesham listened, had been foreseen.
We had a special research section, which was called the SLS, the Special Listening Section, and we had to rely on that section a great deal. That spent its time observing station behavior, keeping a very close eye on new transmissions and disappearance of old transmissions, any kind of broadcasting development. In that section, we had a blind man, John Jarvis, who was an absolutely exceptionally efficient research operator. I always thought that the handicap of his not being able to see would be a tremendous impediment because, of course, he always had to dictate his results at the end of the day. And one day I said to him, well, how do you find your way about? Surely you can't see the dial, and how do you find out what frequency stations are on? And he said to me, well, you know, as I go along the dial, it's like walking down a street. I know exactly who lives in that street and who lives next to whom. And when I go along and I suddenly find that somebody is missing or some new chap has moved in, well, I know the address. I know where he's moved in. And that gives me a clue. And I then, of course, know what the frequency is and of that particular station.
6 months after the invasion of Russia, the war spread still further to the Far East. The year which followed, although it began with a succession of disasters in the Far East, was the one which Winston Churchill later called the hinge of fate. By its end, the monitors were at last able to hear and transcribe news of Allied advances. By now, the monitoring service had reached a high pitch of efficiency and so substantially had the demand for its material increased that the BBC had produced a special guide to explain the service's organization to intending users. Its reputation rested on the accuracy of its output, and here the work of the monitoring supervisors was invaluable. Gradually, what might be called a philosophy of monitoring emerged. Former supervisor Ivan Bilibin, whose native language was Russian.
In the beginning, there was a school which said that the main thing is to put down what you hear. There were some experts somewhere high up in the hierarchy who'd be able to sort out what it all means. But if you hear something, put it down. Well, this, of course, we found out to be a rank heresy. Even if we were dealing with some clandestine station which was passing on some secret message, its medium was the spoken word, and if that spoken word was misheard, the message wasn't conveyed. So the main thing later on, when a new monitors came along, I always used to tell them, don't put all your trust on your ears. Combine ears and brain. You will hear plenty of tripe here, but you will never hear any nonsense. And if you've heard nonsense, you've heard wrong.
For the supervisors and the report writers of the editorial unit, an over-conscientious monitor could be almost as troublesome as a careless one. One of the many academics helping in the large German section at Eatsham was the art historian Ernst, now Sir Ernst Gombrich.
We were actually rather pedantic. We resented slovenliness on the part of other sections. Many of us were trained as scholars, and our respect for the text, respect for the document, came through in our attitude. We probably made a great nuisance of ourselves occasionally, but I still think that was the right attitude.
Another of the Evesham pioneers was the future Lord Weidenfeld. A recently arrived Jewish refugee from Austria, George Weidenfeld had been a student at Dunedin University when summoned to join the famous Mayflower bus, as the monitors called it, to Evesham.
What was exciting and was new was that you suddenly were thrown into a community which really consisted of two very important elements. On the one hand, a very cosmopolitan element, a sort of mini League of Nations, of people of different backgrounds, experience, age groups, different intellectual formation, as well as the people outside the monitoring service who did, in fact, rub shoulders with you at the club, at social functions. Sometimes they might have been billeted in the same house or be neighbors. And they represented, they reflected in miniature the whole microcosm of English society. You were thrown to the deep end of British life.
I'd always been brought up with the idea that the only stiff upper lips you ever met were in Britain, but this is not true, because everybody had the stiffest of upper lips. And yet, they knew, well, in lots of cases they didn't know where their families were, and they suspected, quite rightly, that most of them were in camps. After the war, of course, when they found out where they'd gone to, it was really quite dreadful. Some of them had lost every single relation they had. And they must have been in a terrible state. But they never showed it, except one Dutch girl. I remember she ran out of the listening room sobbing because Rotterdam was being bombed and one thing and another, and she couldn't bear it because she'd lived there. But I never saw anybody else show any emotion at any time.
They were an extremely mixed bunch. I always felt sort of rather like the Foreign Legion. Nobody bothered about what you'd been before. You know, you were just there and you're doing the same job. And there's a vast pool of expertise on almost any subject under the sun. And I was always quite proud when I could tell all these experts an English term they'd never heard of before. And I used to wonder if I'd been right.
It was an absolute model of the way the world ought to be, because it was quite amazing how well we settled down together. I mean, occasionally you got a few grumbles, such as, oh dear, listen to him, he's a bore like all these Germans are, you know, or something like that, or he would forget it, you know, these Russians. But in the main, everybody settled down together and they were wonderfully loyal and we worked magnificently.
The remarkable esprit de corps which soon developed within the monitoring service was no doubt partly due to the extent to which its members' lives were centred on the mansion of Woodnorton and the town of Evesham. Everyone had been uprooted from his home, and often from his native country, and been transplanted into billets which offered varying degrees of comfort and welcome. Apart from their work, it is their billets which most wartime monitors remember best. The BBC had done its best to prepare its employees for this new experience with a circular to its staff which nicely mingled admonition with warning.
Advice to those in billets with lodgings. Lodgings are advertised as places where lodgers are wanted. The lodger is desirous and desired. You are a billetee. You probably don't want to live in a billet. Remember that it is even more probable that the billeteur doesn't want you. The situation obviously requires tact. The billeting charge of 1 guinea a week covers accommodation, breakfast, and a dinner meal. It must suffice that there is a bed available, or space in which a bed can be provided, and that the place is clean. That is all. The billeting officers are doing their best to see that you are going to get more than that, but it is a billet, not an hotel. Inside sanitation is not specified and may not be available. There may or may not be a bathroom. The billeteur is not obliged to provide heated water or a fire in your bedroom. If you are uncomfortable in your relations with your billeteur and diplomacy fails, don't rush to the dreadful arbitrament of war, but talk to the billeting officer.
I came down from Scotland quite convinced I was going to do something over the air, the voice of Britain, instead of which they asked me to be a billeting officer.
Molly Warren Evans. Her job was, she soon found, fraught with special problems peculiar to the BBC.
We were billeting a delightful, cultured German monitor. And the householder's son was away fighting in Germany. They didn't want to know. Terribly difficult like that. The nationality thing sometimes was, and language difficulties.
Or the lack of modern plumbing.
One of the big difficulties at Evesham, to our people coming up with fairly sophisticated backgrounds, were the rather humble accommodation, or from charming little old Victorian Edwardian cottages, where there was no real proper sanitation.
Luckily, thanks to the curious history of Woodnorton, the BBC was able to make generous, even lavish, provision for those sentenced to a bathless billet.
There was the Duke's Bath there, for instance, which is a marvellous room, with a sunken bath, almost magnificent, beautiful coloured porcelain. There was a queue for that one.
I was billeted with a retired market gardener and his wife, who were extremely kind. He used to pipe up my bicycle tires and clean my shoes and bring me strawberries and things. His wife is a very good cook. And I was very lucky to be there because some billetees weren't near so happily placed. People resented them.
I remember one charming young woman arriving. She was an English monitor. I don't know how long she lasted, but she arrived with her horse. That was a bit tricky at about midnight.
In spite of the horror stories from both sides, the people of Evesham ultimately adjusted well to the influx. Stephen Segu was a Hungarian who had arrived in England only in 1938. His previous job in an import agency in the city of London had hardly prepared him for life in a community where most people had probably never even met a foreigner.
It was a rather rural, not to say bucolic, place, and they reacted to the presence of this slightly eccentric gang of lunatics from all corners of the world with unmitigated suspicion. Stories would be repeated to me by my quite benevolent and friendly landlady about orgies in the air raid shelters up in the Woodnorton, and wild parties and terribly improper hours kept by all these bohemian foreigners. The point being, of course, that we worked round the clock, 24-hour shifts, and we would come rolling in on our bicycles from work at 1 o'clock in the morning, and the locals were quite convinced that the billeteers, we were called,
must have been up to some sort of mischief. Otherwise, like respectable people, they would have gone to bed at 9 and been up at 4:30 to milk the cows.
But experience softened even these dark suspicions.
I must admit, some very exotic types turned up. And at first there was a bit of a xenophobic reaction. But then when the time came for us to go, I remember we went in batches on the train, and I was standing on the bridge at Evesham, the railway bridge, watching an extraordinary batch going. You see, there was one old German who did Turkish, and he had a kind of fur balaclava helmet on, and there was another woman carrying a bird cage, and there was another man with a wild fur coat and correspondent shoes. Well, anyway, a very exotic looking bunch, and somebody came up near me and said, "Oh, I am sorry you're going. It livened up the place a bit."
The monitoring service had really been born and had certainly grown to maturity at Evesham, and there to most of its members it seemed to belong. The BBC had decided, however, that it should be moved to Caversham on the outskirts of Reading, partly for technical reasons, but mainly to leave Wood Norton free to become the BBC's emergency headquarters if it had to move from London. In the end, after 18 months of argument and delay, the great move was accomplished in April 1943 without a single day's monitoring being lost. Before that, however, there had been an epic row. For the three senior officials in charge at Evesham, supported by most of their staff, were bitterly opposed to leaving it. The most senior of them, Richard Marriott, then head of the monitoring service, was convinced that the quality of its work would suffer.
What appeared to be going to happen was that when we moved to Caversham, the engineers were not going to be in the same building as the rest of the monitoring service. They were going to be in a house nearby, which was bought at the same time, which was in the centre of the grounds. We were going to go back 2 or 3 years and going to have engineers working to an engineering schedule and sending down to Caversham to these people who would translate obligingly whatever was sent to them. And this was something that both the two heads of the actual reception services and I were totally and absolutely against.
Besides the fear that the monitors themselves might no longer be really in charge, was another equally creditable personal motive.
We were all young men and we were all fit and capable of fighting, and we all, in a sense, felt, I think, a pull away from this. If there was something you could disagree about and strike a blow for the change that you felt was right, at the same time get out and do your part in the war, it would be a good thing, I think.
Eventually, when their protests proved unavailing, the three rebels resigned and joined the forces, where one was to lose his life. Ironically, once the service was re-established at Caversham under new leadership, the rebels' chief demand was conceded.
They did go, and they changed it, and when they got there, they changed it back to the sensible system and worked on that when they got there.
The general public remained unaware of these sterling events, and Richard Marriott now handsomely admits that perhaps the whole hard-fought controversy was unnecessary.
We thought we were right. Perhaps we were wrong.
The monitoring service's new home, Caversham Park, if less crowded, was a come-down after the ducal splendours of Wood Norton. Built for a 19th-century industrialist and previously occupied by a boarding school, it was an architecturally undistinguished mansion in an unexciting suburb. But Caversham offered compensations, not least for those monitors who also had young children.
There was the mummery. You see, they'd been losing key monitors, women, because they had children to look after. So one very kind governor of the BBC suggested that they took Sonning Manor, and children of monitors went there. As a matter of fact, Sonning was a bit disconcerting when we got there, because the rumour went about that this was the home for the BBC's fallen women and their children. But anyway, they soon got used to that. So you had these 32 children, all from very different backgrounds, and they had to shake down together. And at first, it was really quite delightful. We had a butler called Charles, and he was very circumspect. He would lift up the telephone to answer it and say, "Madam is working."
along with the main group of monitors, or M section, the mysteriously named Y unit also moved to Caversham. It was here that Martin Sullivan, who had answered an advertisement for Polish monitors while working for a firm of dry cleaners, joined it and learned for the first time the nature of his new and very different job.
M unit took in the news that monitored for content. Y unit, as such, monitored for behavior or for intelligence. They took things like prisoner of war messages, and they watched the behavior of stations to see if they departed from schedule in any way, if there was anything abnormal about it, if there were certain tunes played. I mean, things had meanings, and the monitor was not always aware of these, but they had instructions to listen and look out for certain things.
If the Germans played any song with the name of Peter in it, and we had a little short list of songs with appropriate titles, such as Peterle, Mein kleines Peterle, we were immediately supposed to telephone the Air Ministry or the Admiralty.
A lot of the items we monitored, bulletins, were in code, so we didn't really know what use they were being, except I remember being told afterwards when we'd monitored a sort of variety programme that they traced the course of a submarine all the way over the Atlantic by this bulletin. So, you know, you felt you were doing something that might be of use.
And it was a very mysterious assignment, which I used to do, I believe, on Thursday afternoon at 1600 hours. You sat yourself down in front of a set on which an Italian station on the 48-metre band or thereabouts had to be tuned in. And at that hour, it played an hour of solid, unannounced martial music and the best fascist Mussolini style. It sort of went oompa, oompa, oompa. When you were seated there, a supervisor came and gave you a very grubby envelope sealed with brown paper tape. You were supposed to undo it in his presence and read this very worn BBC memorandum, which had been folded so many times that it was virtually falling apart. And on this memorandum it said that if they should play the Inno dei Sommergibilisti, which being translated vaguely means the anthem of the submariners, you were to again ring the Admiralty on a certain number. Every Thursday I would go through the same little routine of saying to the supervisor, right, how does it go? And every Thursday I had the same reply, well, that's just a little difficulty, old boy. Nobody knows how it goes. I spent years listening for this elusive tune, and I never did hear it, to my knowledge.
Now, the Y unit itself was still in the main building at Caversham, but away, some 5 miles away in the woods, there was a hut which listened to secret stations. And it was like some enchanted woods. It was eerie to go through at night. There was no one else around there for miles and miles. There was an aerial park, so reception was very good. And there you roamed wave bands to see what you could find by way of unscheduled stations. And the air was really full of them. There were secret stations all over the place, forever stations which claimed to be in somebody's territory. They said they were in a radio van in France, in Algeria, in Poland, you name it. One thing was certain, they never were in the country that they purported to come from, or hardly ever. But you never knew quite which side they were on.
About the value of one task performed by the monitoring service throughout the war, there could be no doubt.
And before we conclude this program, here are some messages from rich prisoners of war to their next of kin. The first one is from Private Thomas Smart, 293-2886. It's addressed to Mrs. T. Smart, 182 Overton Road, Kirkcaldy, Fifeshire, Scotland. Dear Cathy, I was captured by the Germans and am now in Germany. I am well.
Do not worry.
One woman would be what was known as the prisoner queen for the day, and she would retire to a cubicle armed with a gazette, an atlas, and a directory of streets, because you had to get everything absolutely right, and she would then transcribe these prisoners' messages. And then by the time she'd finished, which mostly took her about 4 or 5 hours, she would go out and look for somebody else to check it. I remember one time a man sent his love to a girl, and three of us heard that, three entirely different names. And we were so terrified because we thought he might put the cat among the pigeons, you know, if he sent love to the wrong girl.
The move to Caversham, which came 2 months after the fall of Stalingrad, coincided with a striking upsurge in the fortunes of the Allied armies. This was soon reflected in the style of German broadcasting, as Karl Lehmann noticed.
From that point on, German broadcasts became very much more realistic, although, of course, basically they maintained the same lie which had been at the bottom of all their propaganda right through the war.
Through their headphones, the monitors at Caversham are unable to follow the steady disintegration of the Axis, and sometimes the good news proved too much even for their professional detachment.
For instance, when Mussolini resigned, and the Italian monitor was so excited, she jumped up on a chair, and of course, the nearest person she could find to rush to news bureau was a dear old Austrian doctor, and she said, quick, tell them Mussolini's resigned. So he rushed off to news bureau, and as soon as he got there, he couldn't remember any English. He was so excited, so he said, Mussolini is demissioniert. And then, of course, everybody rather idiotically thought that probably the war would be over, you know, Italy collapsing and all that, and they weren't prepared for this climb up Italy that we had to do. And I remember the Russians took what rations they had and a bottle of vodka and went and sat down by the lake and sat there till the dawn. Quite thought it was the end, carousing like mad.
That celebration on the 25th of July 1943 proved premature. But by the 8th of September, there were more solid triumphs to enjoy.
Il governo italiano, riconosciuta la impossibilità...
Personal message from Marshal Badoglio. The Italian government, recognizing the impossibility of continuing the unequal struggle against the overwhelming power of the enemy, has requested an armistice from General Eisenhower, Commander-in-Chief of the Anglo-US Allied Forces.
9 months later came the long-expected Anglo-American invasion. And then, on the 20th of July, 1944...
I remember the great excitement of the evening of the coup attempt on Hitler's life, and I think most of the regular people had gone off, but sheer fluke, a few of them were still sitting around the canteen having coffee when a very excited supervisor came rushing in and said, look, there's been an attempt on Hitler's life, but he's all right, he's going to speak now.
Ich befehle daher in diesem Augenblick, dass keine zivile Stehende irgendeinen Befehl entgegenzunehmen hat.
To the knowledgeable veterans at Caversham, Hitler's voice seemed but a frail echo of the bullying roar that had terrorized Europe for so long. Soon there were other intimations of approaching victory flowing into the listening room at Caversham.
I remember Russian monitors dancing around the great map in the main hall when they heard about another town having fallen. And these were people who were enemies of the regime. They were simply felt Russian. I think I myself got very excited when I heard about the liberation of Warsaw, months before anybody else knew about it. Suddenly a freedom station was said, we are speaking from Warsaw, and they had liberated at least one bank of the river.
On the 29th of April 1945 came the news of Mussolini's execution by Italian partisans. News of another death was even more eagerly awaited by the monitors.
My wife often asked me, why do you go? You don't feel well. And I said, well, you never know. Maybe Hitler is dead, you know.
And then at last, as Sir Ernst Gombrich recalls,
there was a long sequence of standbys for an important announcement. Then there was a long broadcast of the slow movement of a Bruckner symphony in memory of the death of Wagner, and I reported that as pretty significant. I wrote out, prior to the announcement, two or three options, one of them Hitler dead. And when the announcement came, I was telephoned to Downing Street. So in that sense, I brought the news.
Stephen Seger, whose homeland Hungary had been Germany's unwilling ally, was at that moment in the canteen.
I was having lunch at the time. The loudspeakers were suddenly turned on full blast.
Deutsche Männer, Frauen, Soldaten der deutschen Wehrmacht. Unser Führer Adolf Hitler ist gefallen.
We heard the heartbroken voice of Admiral Dönitz announcing that the Führer had died on the field of honor and that he, Dönitz, had temporarily, or I think for the duration, assumed that function. Never has there been such a dance of spontaneous rejoicing as was staged in that canteen. It was the best news any of us had heard for many years. We spent the whole war monitoring one disaster after another. Colleagues had been sitting there while their own people were, to their certain knowledge, and that included me, being shipped off to Auschwitz. So it was a very grim experience, really.
One of the German monitors on duty on the afternoon of May the 7th, 1945, was Susan Temple.
There was only one transmitter left, one certainly in Flensburg, and we watched it literally every second of the day. And on that particular day, on the 7th of May, there were four of us watching Flensburg, and suddenly I heard it come up, you know, that unmistakable hum that means that the station is coming up. And of course it was immensely exciting, and I shouted, and everybody switched over to that wavelength. And it was Schwerin von Krosigk saying, ich habe allen deutschen Truppen befohlen, die Waffen niederzulegen. Meaning that all the troops had been ordered to lay down arms. And of course that was the word we were waiting for, all. And after about one sentence I rushed off to transcribe it. And then the others took over and the next person did a sentence. And that's how we got it out.
Even in the moment of victory, the monitoring service did not relax its tradition of scrupulous accuracy. On the following morning, while the rest of the country was celebrating VE Day, Anatole Goldberg, who 6 years before had been one of the Mayflower bus pioneers, was still very much on duty.
I remember going there in the morning, and when I arrived, I was told, it's over. I listened to the record. It was translated, it was sent to the editorial department. Then I discovered that there had been a typing slip. And I went up and they said to me, too late, too late. It has been typed and rolled off. So I said, look, this is the end of the Second World War in Europe. We can't leave that translation of that speech in an imperfect state. What will history say? Well, that impressed the editor very much, and although he had strict instructions to economize paper, he did destroy the copies, and it was typed again.
When the camps were liberated, lists of prisoners who had survived were broadcast, day in, day out. The monitoring service could not spare people officially to listen to all these, but there were volunteers who decided they must listen to these reports and, if possible, pass on the news. And there was one of my colleagues who, in volunteering for this work, heard that his sister was alive, and that's an unforgettable moment.
By October 1945, the value of listening to other countries' broadcasts was everywhere accepted, and what had been created as a wartime expedient became one of the country's regular sources of news. It was a strange way to fight a war, eavesdropping on the enemy, listening to lies, sometimes to the truth, an occupation at once solitary and gregarious. To enliven their off-duty hours in exile at Caversham, some monitors had written a review, which after the war was performed in London, though for one night only. Monitors like Lorna Swar and Susan Temple, who had spent the war listening to others, were at last able to move into the limelight.
I spend a lifetime listening. Commentators come and go. I'm rather in a fog as to why I keep a log, but someone always wants to know. Every word that's spoken, every tune a station played, I must keep my wits about me, but it's happened, I'm afraid. I fell in love with a voice, and when he's singing, he sings to me. I fell in love with a voice. I'll tell you why this should be. I'll never find him boring. He'll never have a roving eye. I can safely be adoring. He'll be the first man on whom I can rely. I fell in love with a voice. I couldn't help it. You needn't scoff. I get the best of him. As for the rest of him, do you never wish you could switch off?
Listening to War was written by Norman Longmate and narrated by Alvar Liddell, who recorded the programme last October. The reader was Sean Arnold. Research and interviews were by Robert Hart-Rowe, and the producer was Barbara Crowther.